Welcome into Time Out with Taylor Rooks, now on the SNY.TV audio network. Today's guest is Hall of Fame running back Curtis Martin. Interviewing Curtis truly changed my perspective on life, and that is not an exaggeration at all. I mean, the experiences that he has had and the trials that he has overcome is just simply amazing. His life is a testament to the human spirit and the resiliency of the human spirit. In this episode, he really goes in depth with, you know, how he grew up, moments of domestic abuse and gang violence, and really being in a rough neighborhood. He talks about his mom, who is just an angel, who helped him persevere and be the person he is today. It's really amazing. Football truly saved Curtis's life. That's not an understatement at all. You'll see exactly why that's the case as you listen to this episode. And of course, we also get to some football questions. He gives his thoughts on the Jets and tells us some of his favorite backs to watch at the moment. But in all honesty, the football stuff just truly is not what's important in this conversation. It's so, so much more. So be sure to subscribe to Time Out with Taylor Rooks on iTunes and SoundCloud by searching Time Out with Taylor Rooks. And here is Curtis Martin. Curtis Martin, I am very excited to have a Hall of Famer on the podcast. It is my pleasure to have you.
It's my pleasure.
I mean, I already told you, you look like you could kind of put the uniform on and still go out there.
Well, I already told you, you can start deceiving. I don't think I can get back out there. No, I actually joke about it a lot. I always say I'm gonna come back and get one more 1,000-yard season, then I'm gonna really retire.
Now, if there was a scenario where you played one game, how do you think you would do?
I think I'd do good. I think I could still go out and get 100 yards in the game.
Really?
Yeah, I do a lot of boxing now, so.
You don't want to give Jets fans any ideas.
No. I got too much going on to go back and play football.
Yeah. So you box now. What else do you do to kind of stay in the shape?
Mainly all I do is box. Yeah. I literally go to the boxing ring and I line up about 8 to 10 people and I let them come in and do 2 rounds apiece. And I just tell them to try to knock me out and I don't punch back and I just work on my defense.
No way.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever knocked you out?
No. I've gotten hit, but usually, unless you're a professional or you're a really good boxer, you're not going to be able to hit me in the face if I don't want you to.
So what made you decide to do boxing?
I've always been attracted to boxing. It's one of my favorite sports. Yeah, that and MMA.
Yeah, but what about it? Why do you like those?
You know, I really like the hand-to-hand, one-on-one combat. You know, it's like you against one other person, and it's like the best man comes out. There's something about that competitiveness that I like about boxing.
It's really interesting to just, you know, hear you talk about if there was to be a football comeback or how you'd be able to do if you played football, because one thing about you is you genuinely don't love football.
Well, I didn't, no.
Yeah.
I learned to appreciate football. So for me, football literally saved my life. It got me out of a very dangerous neighborhood and my life was at risk several times. And I've had a lot of family members who didn't make it out of that neighborhood. I've told the story about how we found my grandmother murdered. You know, my aunt was burned to death. My best friend was shot in the chest and died. I have countless stories about that. And my mother came to me when I was in high school and said, I want you to just do anything. And football was just the thing that came most, that was the most natural thing. So I did that just to stay out of trouble.
It led
me to college, and I ended up getting a scholarship, and it led me into the NFL.
Would you say football really did save your life?
Oh, yeah, literally. I feel indebted to football. And even though it wasn't my, like, first love, and I didn't just grow up as a football fan. Like, I didn't even play until really my junior, senior year in high school. Just didn't have the interest. But I knew I could always do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had one of the best Hall of Fame speeches ever. For people that have not heard it, you did go very in-depth about your family, some of the experiences that you've had. Can you just kind of go through, you know, those times that you had growing up?
Yeah, well, you know, one of my, when I look back in hindsight, one of my favorite parts about growing up was that, you know, so my mother couldn't afford this babysitter. We had this woman who would watch me, but she would charge $2. And we were so poor, like, my mother couldn't afford the $2. So at 5 and 6 years old, she taught me how to stay in the house by myself. So she tied this little key around my neck. I would come home from school. I would stay there till 9, 10 o'clock at night, because she would work 3 jobs trying to just keep clothes on my back and food on the table. And by the time I was 7, you know, and I was so petrified in the house, I just got smart. And it taught me how to think for myself. It taught me how to problem solve, just spending that time alone. So when I was going into second grade, I believe, on my way home, I would start carrying groceries, or I would knock on a person's door and ask, could I shovel their snow or rake their leaves? And every day I got home, I had somewhere between $2 and $5, and I would give it to my mother and say, you know, pay for the babysitter for the next couple of days. Yeah, so yeah. It taught me how to, you know, at a very young age. Like, I have a 5-year-old now who's about to turn 6, and I can't imagine her in those situations. And but it helped me grow up probably a little too fast, but I like the way it taught me how to think.
Your mom sounds like an angel.
Oh, my mother is like, she's like my hero.
Yeah.
You know, when you see someone sacrifice so much, and after what she had been through, I mean, like, she literally, her and her mother were like super close. I mean, she literally walks in the house and, you know, she's excited to go see her mother, and her mother's lying in the bed with a broken neck and her eyes wide open and a knife. The guy who killed her, he embedded the knife so far into her chest, like straight through her heart, that it was sticking out her back and it was stuck in the bed. And there was blood everywhere. My mother literally had to witness that herself, you know.
Yeah, and your mom found her mom.
Yeah. And she tells the story to everyone that the only thing that got her through that was me thinking that she was going to go crazy and constantly asking her if she's going crazy. And, you know, she said that that was the only thing that kept her together and gave her the strength to push through, because she knew, especially in the environment that we lived in, that if she wasn't there, there's no telling what would happen to me. And so I just praise my mother, because I know that she literally sacrificed her entire life just to make sure that I was okay.
Now, do you remember those moments? Like, do you remember being 5 years old, telling your mom this vividly?
Yeah, I remember. Let me see your hand. I grabbed her hand like this. I said, Mom, are you going crazy? Are you going crazy? Oh. And she said, and this is when, I'm 9 at this time, because that's when my grandmother got murdered. And she looked at me and she said, why are you asking me that? And I told her, I said, if you go crazy, who's going to raise me? There's nobody's going to be here. And she was just like, that just like gave her, it was like gave her wind, you know, and helped her make it through it.
And that's really just the strength of mothers. Moms sometimes are just so underappreciated.
Yeah.
Just they have the strength and the willpower and the discipline to be able to get through things that people can't even imagine, just out of the love of their children.
You know something, her getting through that wasn't the biggest thing to me. I literally watched her get beat. I'm talking about like a man. I mean, my father used to beat her to death. I mean, black eyes, the whole bit. I mean, her whole body would be bruised up. I told the story about how he would burn her with cigarettes, you know, and she has those marks on her legs to this day. And to see her just fight every day, and back then, the law wasn't as enforced as it is today, you know. So he could get out of jail and he'd come right back the next day and abuse her some more because he had to go to jail. And I was always that kid jumping on his back and trying to punch him and everything just to protect my mother. And to see her go through years of that, and then as soon as that ends, her mother gets killed, and a few years after her mother gets killed, her sister gets burned to death, and then her brother, you know, loses his life, and it was just a whole lot on her. And to see her bear up under all of that pressure and all of those different circumstances and still stay focused to raise me. I mean, like I said, she's my
hero. It's amazing. I'm gonna start
crying.
Honestly, it's so emotional. But that's the thing. And I read something about you talking about the power of forgiveness and how there's so much strength in being able to forgive somebody. And your mom did that with your dad. Something that I think some people wouldn't even be able to fathom. She was able to do that.
Yeah. So, from the time I was, he was permanently gone by the time I was like six, but I would go visit him over at his mother's house because he started living with his mother. She was very reluctant to let me go over there to see him. But as a young boy, I mean, for some reason, you just admire your father. Mm-hmm. You want to be around your father. And I remember I would go over there and she would give me maybe $10 for the weekend. He would take the $10. He'd go, I mean, he was strung out on drugs. He would go buy drugs, stay out, come back right before my mother would come pick me up on Sunday, and I wouldn't tell on him, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was our little pact. But for me as a young kid, it was like just to have that moment when I went there and before I left, I knew I would see him. And so I was fine with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that there is this idea that when somebody grows up and they see something, that that is how they're going to end up acting. Yeah. How did you combat that, and how did that feel you to say, you know what, this is not who I'm going to be. I'm going to be different, and that's the most important thing for me.
Well, that's usually the case.
Yeah.
I do a lot of, like, coaching people now, you know, and there's this term called repetition compulsion. And what it means is that you'll end up repeating the pains or the circumstances or situations that you vowed to never repeat because you saw it growing up. And a lot of people still end up repeating those situations because it's so ingrained in your mind. You know, I really appreciate the fact that I didn't grow up and like abuse women in any way, verbally or whatever it may be. What it did for me is it made me respect women so much more, you know? So you can't disrespect a woman around me. I don't care who you are. I just don't like that, you know? And I think it's because I saw so much of it growing up.
What do you think is the biggest just lesson you learned about yourself growing up?
About myself growing up? I would probably have to say that your circumstances and your situations, they don't have to define you. You know, I realized that I had the ability to define myself regardless of what I come from. So most of the people who come from that environment, I think I begin to see how the environment began to define them. And so they begin to live accordingly. And I was just always determined to defy that environment and be able to come back and pour into that environment and help the people think differently. And so I think that's one of the greatest lessons that I've learned. Another really good lesson that I've learned is that problems are necessary, you know?
Mm-hmm. That is so true.
I think hard times are necessary.
Yes.
I do a lot of writing sometimes, and I wrote this thing where it says, God allows problems in your life for 5 reasons. Number 1, to direct you. Number 2, to inspect you. Number 3, to correct you. Number 4, to protect you, and number 5, to perfect you, right? And it's like, because going through all that I've gone through, it was like, that was my way of making sense of like, okay, why, if there's a God, why does he allow these things? And I wouldn't trade one day of it because I really appreciate the man that I am today.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I love that. You've also had a near-death experience.
Several.
Yeah, several.
Yeah,
I've only read about one.
I only talk about a few, but I've had several, yeah, and that was the reason why I had to play football. I mean, I had several near-death experiences before I was even out of high school.
Tell me about those.
Yeah, I spoke about the one where the guy had the gun in my head and he pulls the trigger like 8 times and no bullet comes out, and then he pulls the trigger not pointing the gun at my head and the bullet just comes out.
And, what is going through your head in that moment?
You know something? I think growing up in that environment, you get this false sense of, I don't care, you know? Like, you get this false sense of, I'm probably going to die. Like, I had accepted the fact that I would probably die before I was 21. And so I think that I really convinced myself that I didn't fear death.
And even while he was pulling the trigger?
You know something? That type of life teaches you to deal with reality. And, you know, at the end of the day, what can I do? You know, and so, but I've had far more situations, other situations that were, I feel, even more frightening to me. The first time I felt like I almost lost my life, or my life really was going to change for the worse, was when I was 14 years old. Now, when I was 14, mind you, I looked like I was probably like 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. And I carried myself that way. I've always, I think, been a very mature person. And I go to this African Day parade, and it's like in the hood, and it's supposed to be the one time that there's no violence and that there's no crime. It's supposed to be like the one day everyone's at peace. And I'm with my girlfriend, and we're walking down the street, and we hear this like herd of people running behind us. And you know, if you turn around and you see a huge crowd running, it had to be about 30 people. So we try to hurry up and get to the corner and just get around the corner so that they could just keep going straight. Yeah. And we don't get trampled or anything. And they get to the corner and they stop and they surround me and her. And we're standing in the middle of this circle with guys who I now know have like been in some really, really like bad situations. And I don't know if people aren't living because of some of these guys in this circle. So anyways, they surround us and I'm like shocked, you know, and I'm this 14 year old boy.
Yeah.
And these guys are 20, 19, you know, 23. And, this one guy who was like the ringleader, he says, "Oh, hold this MF-er right here until Carlos gets here." And I said, "Me?" He said, "Yeah, you don't act like you don't know nothing now." And I'm like flabbergasted. I'm like, "Listen, man, I don't know what you're talking about." He said, "Well, wait till Carlos get here." Carlos eventually comes, and he comes through the crowd, and I look at him, and I'm like, "Oh, my God." This guy had on some ripped jean shorts. I'll never forget. He had tattoos all over his body, and he had a cut from this ear that went all the way across his head to this ear.
Oh, my goodness.
And he comes through the crowd, and he says, "You see what y'all did to me?" I said, "I did to you?" I said, "I didn't do anything to you, man. I don't even know you." And he's telling me, like, "Don't act like you don't know me now. I'm pretty sure that's him." And all of them, I mean, they had knives, everything. I was either going to die, or my best case scenario was what Carlos had.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to come out better than him. And I'll never forget the fear that I had that day at 14 years old. You know, that was one of my most fearful moments to this day that I've ever faced. And just before they were about to jump on me, I said to them, I said, "Well, listen, man, I'm promising you, tomorrow y'all gonna wake up and on the news, you're gonna find out that y'all killed or really changed the wrong person's life for the worse." And I said, "Before y'all do anything, I'm just asking one thing, just let my girl go across the street." And they literally got quiet for a second, then they parted the circle and let her go across the street. And just as they was about to close in, one of the guys who was in the group made it to the front and realized that it was me. And he was my cousin. He's like, "Man, this isn't that guy. This is my little cousin."
Oh, my goodness.
And he puts his arm around my neck and walks me out of the crowd. And I spoke at that guy's funeral last year. And I told that story about how my life wouldn't be the same if it wasn't
if
for that
he did
guy.
Not save you yeah, in that situation.
Yeah.
That is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like with all of these situations that have happened to you, for you to be so joyful and calm and at peace is really like just a miracle of the human spirit for you to still be here at this moment.
Well, you know, again, I look at all of those situations And instead of being bitter, it made me grateful, you know, because I know how easy it was for me not to be even sitting here talking to you. So I'm the type of guy who anymore, I don't take life for granted. You know what I mean? For me, I maximize every day. I enjoy living. I remember a time where I used to hate living, you know, and mainly because I was living with the fear of dying, you know, and, you know, it's a tremendous pressure for some of these kids who are in those environments that they're up against. And I think Maine America don't really understand that type of pressure. And not that they're supposed to, but I think it's people like me who can understand and who can help.
Now, obviously, there was a lot of fear in your childhood, but I'm sure there was also a lot of happiness. I want to hear some of the joy that you went through going up, some of the good times with your mom. What was some kind of good memories that you have?
Good memories were simple for me. Like, mm-hmm. It was the simple things that were good for me. Like, what was good for me was that days where, you know, my father was in jail and me and my mother could just be at home by ourselves. My mother, it was almost like our luxury. Like, once a month or so, she would try to take me to Red Lobster because she knew I loved crab legs. So for me, it was very simple, but those were like the best moments of my life growing up. You know, when I was younger, you know, I didn't get to do a lot of the things. I didn't have the opportunity to be a kid. I had to, you know, somewhat be an adult, a protector at a very young age. And so my life now, I feel like now life is repaying me for all of those hard times, because my mother actually said to me out of her own mouth, she said, "Kurt, listen, you are the most genuinely at peace and happiest person that
and you
I
seem like
even
it.
Know."
Yes.
You know? And she's kind of followed the trail, you know, and to see her, how happy she is today, I think that's one of my greatest accomplishments in life.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
So when was the moment that you said, you know what, football is a thing that can help my mom, it can get me to this place? When did you know that would be the vehicle for you?
I literally didn't know that until I got hurt during my senior year of college.
Really?
And I missed the entire season. And I made my mind up, because I'm the type of guy who, you can't really tell me that I can't do anything. Like, I feel like anything's impossible, and I don't limit myself, you know? And I believe that if I put my mind to whatever I'm doing, I can accomplish it. So it was during that time when I was injured and the whole season was passing by and it looked like my NFL hopes were, you know, diminished or gone, that I just made my mind up to, I said, you know what? I would be a fool to have this opportunity, to have this talent, and squander it. And I remember that very moment that I decided that I wasn't going to waste this talent. That was when I felt like I was going to make it into the NFL, and that's when I felt like the NFL would be the reason why I would be able to change my mother and a lot of other people's lives through football.
Now, at that moment, did you think, you know what, I'm going to play football and eventually be in the Hall of Fame?
No.
Or did
no,
you just think,
no,
you know what, no. I'll be able to get there, make some money, help my family?
Yeah. I just thought, like, I will at least be able to get my mother out of the hood. That was my number one goal, and to buy her a car. That was my dream.
What car did you get?
I got her a Range Rover. It's
Very
always
nice.
Been it's always been her. It was always her dream car. And when I first got my signing bonus in the NFL, I bought her a house. I spent my whole signing bonus on her house, on her car, and I hired a personal assistant to do everything else so I could just focus on football.
I love it.
Those were the three things that I spent all my money on.
When you saw that check, that huge amount of money, I mean, what's the first thing that went through your mind when you saw it?
Well, first of all, it wasn't really a huge amount of money.
What
I got
it?
Drafted in the third round.
Yeah, you wouldn't have had that big of a...
So, and back then, you know, what they make minimum is more than what you were making in the third round back then. So I was making like, I think I had like a 3-year deal that was worth like $900,000. So I was making roughly $300,000 a year.
Yeah, well, how much was your signing bonus?
My signing bonus was, I I think $191,000.
That's a huge amount of money.
It's a huge amount of money. It is a huge amount of money.
I'll take it.
No, it couldn't have been 190. Yeah, it was $191,000. Yeah, exactly. And after taxes, you gotta figure that's like 100. And so after
it's a lot
putting
of zeros.
Yeah, it's good money. It's good money. I appreciated it. And I just said, well, worst case scenario, if I get hurt tomorrow, at least I can say that I bought my mother a house.
Yes.
Yeah.
And is she still living in that house? Or is she
not
somewhere
in that one.
Else?
No,
okay. You said she's in Georgia enjoying
No. She didn't move there, so I sold that house.
But gotcha.
I got her new dream house in Pittsburgh.
I love it. How often do you guys really just sit and think about how far you've come?
All the time.
Yeah.
Like we reflect on it a lot because You know, I've shared some of my story, but I've like shared maybe 15% to the public. There's so many things. Like people would, you know, just not believe some of the stories that I have to tell.
Yeah.
And so me and my mother and I talk about those things all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your very first football game.
Yeah.
Tell me kind of your mindset going into that. Was it you still kind of in disbelief that you were even there?
No.
It set in at that point.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing is for me, once I set my mind to do something, I feel like I'm not going to lose. And so my very first game, I'll never forget feeling that. I've never felt that nervous. You know, I was really nervous. And I ended up having the last play of the game to win the game, I scored a touchdown.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of those moments for me that was a defining moment, and one of those moments that I'll always remember.
I'm sitting here talking to you and hearing your story, and all I'm thinking in my head is people care too much about football.
Yeah.
Because it's
so
minuscule.
in
the grand scheme of your life.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always thought that football was a vehicle.
Yeah.
You know, football is a means it's an opportunity to change a lot of things in your life. Most of us, I mean, I think it's, 75%, you know, young black men who come into the NFL. So, and most of them come from similar backgrounds as mine. And so I think that it's a really great opportunity. I really wish that players would keep that in mind, because it's very easy to lose track of that once you come in contact with all the money and the fame and the power. You know, I always say that learning what I've learned, if I had an enemy, you know, I'd just give him all the money, fame, and power that I could and just sit back and watch him destroy himself, you know, because I've literally seen how those things can take you away from who you really are, who you want to be, where you want to go, simply because they are such a distraction. They just feed your ego and they feed your pride. And, you know, you're so full of yourself that you can't really see straight.
I think it's easy to come from a place and get somewhere so different that your only thought is not wanting to ever go back to that place, whether it be helping, whether it be just like going back to see it. You want to be so far removed from that, but that ends up hurting you even more because you're forgetting how you ended up where you are at this moment. And I think a lot of athletes battle with that.
Well, the unfortunate thing is that most of them end up right back where they didn't want to go to, that repetition compulsion thing, you know? And I think that it largely has to do with the fact that you don't really know how to handle that level of money, that level of fame, that level of power. So instead of it helping you and pushing you forward,
it
actually damages you internally, you know, and mentally and emotionally over the course of time.
Yeah. I mean, I also think, though, there is this idea that young guys growing up, specifically black men, think the only way to get out of where you are is to rap or play a sport.
Right.
And I, a lot of time, wish that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
Because the chances of that being the thing that gets you out are so slim, and the chances of all the other things that you could do, whether it be a lawyer, be a doctor, start a business are so much higher. But since the representation of only seeing black men on a field or with a mic, you don't know that you can do anything else.
Right.
I just wish there was a way to kind of change their mind and thinking and really limiting themselves, saying those are the only two options. But I don't even know how you would get to the meat of that.
Well, the thing is exposure.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of those guys, they haven't seen anything other than that. I'll tell you, and I always tell this guy this, and we laugh about it, and I'm sure he's tired of me telling him this, but the life-changing moment for me was my friend, he used to be a producer, music producer.
Okay.
And he used to work with Dre and Snoop. He used to work with Dre and Snoop, and he used to basically live out there in L.A. Mm-hmm. And I went out to visit him, and I was maybe 17 or so, you know, and this is when... or 18, this like when Snoop first came out and was like huge, and Dr. Dre was, they were massive. And I went out there, and I'll never forget, like the whole Dr. Dre Snoop crew were in his pool room shooting pool. And I asked Dre, could I just walk around in his house? And he said, yeah, go ahead. And I remember standing in his living room, and I was just looking around like, wow. And he had told me how much the house cost. And I was just sitting there and I said to myself, I said, I can do this if I really want to, I can do it. But it was just the fact of seeing something outside of my circle.
And knowing that, it's in your grasp.
Yeah. That made me think beyond that. And that's what I try to do. I try to give a lot of the younger kids exposure to different things, but also give them the wisdom to deal with it and to understand how to get there.
Because, I mean, do you remember the first time you saw, you know, a black man that wasn't an athlete or an artist? That was doing something that made them, you know, a good living, but it wasn't something that you would think.
Well, I know this isn't what you're saying, but for me, those were all the drug dealers in the neighborhood. And that's what happens to a lot of these kids. They grow up wanting to be the drug dealer more so, or the gang leader, than more so even than the rapper or the athlete, because that's more feasible, that's more viable for them. And so I saw all of those things. And you know, what most people don't understand is that kids are constantly under that pressure in that environment to stay away from it. And it becomes very difficult for most of them. And that's why the death rate and the homicide rate is so high in those neighborhoods.
I'm sure you'll meet a lot of men that will come up to you and say, you know what, I'm working, I'm trying to be a football player, like that's my goal, I watch you, all this stuff. Is your instinct ever to say, you know, do something else?
Well, no, because I always think to myself, if someone would have told me to do something else when I had finally set my mind to do it, my thoughts are, look, they're young enough. They'll get to that point where either sports will happen or not, but they'll still have time to do something else, you know? And I usually try to just help them be aware that, you know what, that there's a high percentage of the chance that it may not happen. Now, I believe in you. I hope that it can happen. But if it doesn't, think about this. And, you know, they'll say, well, what do I do here? And I just start opening their minds up to other possibilities, which ends up being more beneficial to them over the course of time.
Well, I am so happy it worked out for you. This whole story has been so incredibly moving, and I'm happy you ended up in New York. You are so beloved here, just as a Jet. So I'd love to hear your favorite memory as a Jet.
As a Jet?
Yes.
I think one of my favorite memories was just coming here. Bill Parcells had just left the New England Patriots, and he drafted me. And he had always, you know, after my first year as a rookie, I got Rookie of the Year and made it to the Pro Bowl. And so we went back to the negotiating table and said, I said, Coach, look, I think I'm outperforming my contract. And I'll never forget him saying to me, he said, well, son, listen, you did it for 1 year. People get lucky. I'm not saying that you're lucky. You have a great amount of skill. He said, but show me that you could do it another year. He said, and I promise you, I'll take care of you if you do it another year. So I go to the Pro Bowl again my second year, and we go to the Super Bowl. And Then going into my third year, he leaves and goes to the Jets. Mm-hmm. And so when I was able to reunite with him and come here, like that was that, like that's one of the things that sticks out in my mind, mm-hmm. Is coming here to New York.
Okay, yeah, now yeah. We'll
and another, I'm sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
No, but one of my first most memorable moment was in my rookie year playing against the Pittsburgh Steelers, because I'm from Pittsburgh and
you had to demolish them.
Yeah, yeah. Like everyone in Pittsburgh, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're a baby or a grandmother, you're a Steeler fan. Mm-hmm. And just playing against them that first game and like doing really well, that was one of the most memorable playing moments in my career.
Okay. Now, we'll get back to Parcells in a bit, because I know how big of a role he has played in your life.
Yeah.
But I am just very curious about that Patriots to Jets transition. Obviously, the Jets pulled off this like completely complex and just mischievous contract to be able to secure you.
Right.
How involved were you in that?
Not at all.
Okay.
I had one of the best agents, and he just passed maybe 2 years ago.
Okay.
But I literally had one of the best agents, and he figured out something that had never been done. I mean, it was to the point that after they did it and got me in New York, they literally changed the laws. Like, you can't do that anymore.
And, yeah.
But that was the only way I got here.
Was there ever a doubt that you wouldn't end up?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally, because, excuse me. After my second year and Parcells left, I'll never forget riding in the car with Mr. Kraft and the owner of the Patriots. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him about renegotiating my contract. And he and I were really close, because he would take me over to his home on the Jewish holidays and allow me to celebrate the Jewish holidays with them. And so we were really close. But I remember him telling me that what they were going to offer me, and it was not even it was a third of what I ended up getting in New York. And I just chose to bet on myself, you know. And I told him, I said, Mr. Kraft, with all due respect, I just think I'm worth more, and I'm willing to take that chance. He said, well, you know, at running back, it's so easy to get hurt, and your career's, you know, statistics say that you won't play more than 3 years. I said, yeah, but I've taken, you know, worse odds,
yeah.
and I've won.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm just that type of guy. I remember looking him right in the face. I said, Mr. Kraft, I'm just that type of guy that wins. Somehow, I guarantee you, maybe it's here, maybe it's somewhere else, it's going to work out for me. And I said, and you don't ever have to worry about getting any less of a player or any less of a commitment from me. I understand that this is just business.
Did you have any conversations with him after he saw how well you did as a Jet?
Yeah. He and I are still really close.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I went to Israel with him a couple years ago. I mean, we're still really, really close. And okay. To me, it's business. I know that he really cared for me. I was probably one of his favorite players at that time. Mm-hmm. And his wife and I were really close. She would cook for me.
Yeah.
And because she knew I was up there by myself initially. And so I knew that they cared for me. It was just business.
Do you think, this is just a curiosity that I have, do you think that Mr. Kraft, as you call him, has a bit of a bad reputation? Or do you think that it's just he's maybe misunderstood, it's a misconception? Because I feel like the only people that like him are Patriots fans.
Yeah, no, you know what? The people who like him are people who know him.
Yeah.
The people who don't know him, they probably don't like him. I mean, because mainly, like, the Patriots are like that team that always wins. So, number one, you just have that against you. Mm-hmm. And, but to know him, I mean, he's one of the kindest hearts and just such a great person. So, I think you find it hard to find someone who really knows him who doesn't like him.
Well, I know that you obviously were happy with your transition to the Jets. I know you said you still watch the Jets. The Jets and the Patriots are the only two teams you really pay that much attention to.
Right.
What do you think of Jets this season? You surprised?
No, I'm not surprised. I was banking on them being better than what most people thought. I don't know how long it will last. I'm hoping that they can stay on the path that they're on. One of the things that I always pay attention to is the effort. You know, because effort can win over talent. You know, like I always say, there were so many guys who were more talented than me at running back on the team every year, but they didn't have the heart, they didn't have the tenacity, they didn't have the whatever that I had. So they never took my position. And I think that teams can form that way and just have that scrappy attitude. And that's what I see in the Jets. I'm hoping that they can keep it up.
Do you go there often? Are you involved a lot with the players, with coaching staff? Do you interact with them?
No, I'm pretty close to the owner.
Yeah.
You know, me and Woody are pretty cool, and his brother. I love his mother. Like, we have this ongoing joke that his mother, who's, I don't know, well, I'm not even going to talk about her age, but she's the most beautiful woman, and you know, she's, the joke is that she's my girlfriend.
Oh, I love it.
And she told my wife, I just saw her at the game, she told, yeah. She said, I had them before you did. You know, and so we're really cool, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that that's one thing when I was telling some people here that you were coming in, I mean, their faces were lighting up. I mean, I love Curtis Martin. It's just like every Jets fan has such fond memories of you on the field, which is, I think, amazing. I don't think that there's always players that have a resounding good taste in everybody's mouth, but I think you are one of those players.
Well, you know, I find that I am very well receptive. Received in New York. Mm-hmm. And I think because I'm a no-nonsense guy. I went to work, I did my job. They know that I gave my all, and I think people respect that.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
I'm putting you on the spot with this.
Okay.
What's going to be the Jets' record at the end of this season?
I don't know their record, but I think they'll come very close, and I think they'll be a wild card in the playoffs.
Really?
Yeah.
We're going postseason.
That's what I
read something at some point where you said you think they're on the way to being a Super Bowl team.
Well, no, I don't know when that was.
I mean, to be, I think it was like September of last year.
And they're rebuilding.
Yeah.
So I think that this is how you start to build a Super Bowl team. Would I choose them as the first team right now? No, to be honest with you. I think that they have a very young group, and I think that they're really just learning how to play together, and they're doing it well so far. But I've been a part of the NFL long enough to know that it's that marathon and not that sprint that the NFL is, and that's going to be the test of time. Mm-hmm. How they finish up this year will... And for me, it's not about how many games they win.
Mm-hmm.
It's about having this consistent effort that they're showing now. Because if you have that type of effort, you'll eventually win games.
Yeah, and I almost think that preseason perception of them being a winless team helped them. I don't think any of them wanted that. And we're going to go out there. We're going to prove everybody wrong in this respect. Because everyone was talking about them being the worst team in the NFL. And now it's kind of flipped and the Giants don't have a win. But does that make you happy at all that the Giants don't have a win?
No. I want the Giants to do well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want them to do better than I want the Jets, but I want them to do well. I think that they're a good team. I think Eli's a good guy. You know, and I feel, bad for Odell.
You know?
I think he's one of the most tremendous talents in the league, and to have him gone I think it not only hurts the team, but it hurts the league.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, watching him, it's like a show.
Yeah.
Every game, it's a show. So it's really unfortunate that this is what has happened for the Giants this season. But I'm sure fans have lots of questions for you. So we're going to get to the Twitter questions.
All right.
If you're ready.
I'm ready.
Let's see here. All right. You've got a lot. Had a lot of notifications.
Okay. Oh, that went fast.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, running your mouth.
Talking too much. Alrighty, question number one. What was the difference in coaching styles between all of your coaches? And this is somebody who works here, so he said, also, can I meet you when you're done? I think he's in the building.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, definitely. We can meet.
Yes.
The difference in coaching styles is that I think Parcells was unlike all the other coaches. But I think all the other coaches had that, because many of them were Parcells coaches previously. But I think that they came from that cloth, but they weren't quite Parcells. But I think they had that mentality, they had that that focused, you know, but they were a different type of coach. Some coaches are considered player coaches. Mm-hmm. Parcells was not considered a player coach. He was considered, like, for lack of better words, more like a dictator type of coach.
Yeah.
And I think that especially in certain situations, it's necessary because you have a lot of young guys. If you don't, like, really get us focused, you know, the way a team gels determines how far that team is going to go.
Sure. Yeah. Good answer. Okay, this person says, I remember a staircase you used to run. It was featured mm-hmm. on a segment about you. Where mm-hmm. was the staircase, and when's the last time you've been there?
Well, I haven't been there since I retired. And it was in Santa Monica in California.
Okay.
It was a Santa Monica stairs, they call them. And there's like 378 of them. I counted them. And
oh, wow.
I would literally plan my off season around going out there and just training for, you know, a month or a few weeks at a time. And every day I'd get up and I'd go run those stairs because that was like my secret sauce.
Yeah.
Because if you run stairs, I mean, it literally builds everything up except your arms. Mm-hmm. And like my legs and my ankles and everything would be so strong and I would have so much burst. Because for me, at a running back position, it's not about being the fastest. It's just about being patient enough, but then having the burst to get through the hole when it occurs. And that's what I focused on.
This is like making me want to be a running back. Like, I can suit up and do this. You hear that, running backs listening? Go run stairs. All right, next question. Kind of touched on this, but what was it like transitioning from one team to their division rival?
Fun. I like that. It's almost like playing against your brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and saying, you know, when I was with, I'll never forget the time when the year that Parcells came to the Jets and I was still at the Patriots and they came up there to play us. I was like, there's no way we get off this field with them winning a the game.
Yeah.
And I ended up having one of my best games in that game. But that's the way I was against Parcells. Like, I didn't want him to win hardly at one time until I came to the Jets.
Yeah. What were the conversations like after the game?
Yeah, I mean, I would tell you. So they did this special and they were, you know, they interviewed me and Parcells and we were talking about how when they came up to play us for the first time, every time I had a good run, I would literally walk up their sideline and just stare at him and just, like, you know, almost like mock him, like,
take that.
Yeah, like, that's what you get for going to the Jets.
Yes.
You know? And after the game, he came up to me, he said, who you think you're staring at like that, Boy Wonder? I know what you're doing. I see you. I said, well, that was just the way, what I was doing to get myself pumped up for the game, Coach.
Yes, yeah. I love that. Yeah. I love that. Okay, last question. I think we have time for one more since we talked forever. What are some running backs that you enjoy watching? I'm assuming they mean in the league right now.
In the league,
yes.
Right now, yeah. I like watching Le'Veon because mm-hmm. I think he epitomizes that concept of patience and bursting. I like the guy from Atlanta. I really like him.
Freeman?
I think, yeah,
yes.
Freeman. I think
go Falcons, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I really like Freeman. You know, I've always liked Marshawn Lynch.
Yes.
And I know he's
so
in
happy
his
he's
latter
back.
Years. But,
yeah.
And I like Ajayi. How do you pronounce his name?
Jay Ajayi.
Yeah. I really like him. So there's a lot of running backs that I really like. The guy from the rookie from Kansas City, Hunt?
Kareem Hunt.
I look for different little things in running backs, and there's certain things that lets you know that person is special. And
What is it? Now I'm curious. What are the little things you look for?
There's a certain way that you can tell that this guy just has this innate vision.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, it's unbelievable. For anyone, they should have a roller coaster ride or amusement park ride that is like being a running back, because you're literally, it just looks like this on the field. And after a while, this starts to slow down for you and you like see this and you know.
Yeah.
And so when you can see someone set that up and anticipate it and while it's gone and then they hit it real fast, like that's a special
quality. Like something you almost can't teach.
Yeah, you can't teach that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's innate.
Well, you have been an absolute pleasure. I feel
it's
like I learned so much. I mean, it's just such a moving story, and I am just so happy that you have a happy ending.
Oh, you seem so deserving
of it. And I thank you for taking the time. Honestly, it was my pleasure. I'm so happy you came on.
Definitely my pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
You know, I really don't even know what to say after that interview. He was fantastic. All he had to do was tell his story, and it just left such an impact. And I mentioned this a bit in the interview, but fans tend to somewhat glamorize the struggles of athletes before they made it big. It's this, you know, rags to riches story of, oh, he was in the hood and now he made it big. But it's just not as simple as that. Many of these athletes have gone through some really real things, and it's not a simple, oh, I used to be poor and now I'm rich. Like for some, like Curtis, it's, I used to fear for my life. I used to be in danger and now I'm okay. Not because I play a sport, but because I worked hard. I mean, he was outstanding. And I am just so happy that someone like him, who is so kind-hearted and has been through so many tough ordeals, is living in true happiness. And I am so thankful to him for coming on and sharing his story. And thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it. Like, subscribe, and leave a review if you haven't yet. I'm Taylor Brooks. Talk to you soon.